Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading Delilah of the Snow by Hilda Binhoff. Chapter 11. Ingleby ventures a remonstrance. It was late in the afternoon when Ingleby, who led two jaded pack horses, limped into the Green River Canyon. His long boots, which were caked with a mire of leagues of travel, galled him cruelly. Every joint was aching, and it was only by an effort he kept himself on his feet at all. It had rained most of the way from the distant settlement, where he had been for the flour Hetty had asked for, and during the last week he had slept by snatches amidst the dripping fern while the pitiless deluge thrashed the fir trunks that indifferently sheltered him. The few strips of natural prairie in the valleys had turned to treacherous swamps, where he sank to the knee, and every few miles there was a furious torrent to be forded perilously. Had he been called on to make that journey under such conditions, when fresh from England, he would probably never have reached the canyon. But strenuous toil with pick and shovel and the simple life of the wilderness had hardened him and endued him with the strength of will which holds the worn-out body in due subjection. Man's capacity for endurance is, as even the hard-handed bushman knows, moral as well as physical. But Ingleby was making his last effort when he reached the great rift between the hills. The river roared close beneath him, swirling among its boulders, stained green with the clay of a great glacier, and overhead the somber pines were blurred by mist and rain. No laden beast could scale the slope they clung to, and on a treacherous bank of gravel, on which a man could scarcely keep his footing, dropped to the river. Just outside the slushy trail, Ingleby sank ankle-deep in mire at every step, but he held on doggedly, with a hand on the leading horse's bridle and the rein on his face, for Ledger's camp was not very far away, and he feared that if he rested now, his worn-out limbs might fail him when he came to start again. That was sufficient to account for the sudden hardening of his face when a thud of hoofs came out of the rain. The trail was especially soft and narrow just there, and it would evidently be a risky matter to attempt to lead two horses past each other. Thrusting the leading beast close in to the inner side, he raised his voice as two figures materialized amidst the trunks in front of him. Down in that great hollow the light was dim, but the clatter of accoutrements told him it was a couple of police troopers who were approaching. "Stop where you are until I get by. There's scarcely room for both of us," he said. It was evident that the men heard him, for one said something to the other sharply, but they did not stop. They came on at a floundering trot instead, until Ingleby saw who the foremost was and pulled the pack horse across the trail. Then there was a musical jingling as the men drew bridle, and Ingleby and the leader looked at each other. He wore an officer's uniform, and there was just then a little sardonic gleam in his dark eyes. He was also very like the man Ingleby, who now knew he bore the same name, had faced at Willow Dean. "Why didn't you pull up behind there, Packer?" he asked. "You couldn't have got past Captain Esmond," said Ingleby. "I was well into the narrow stretch when I called to you." "That," said the policeman, "is a trifle unfortunate. For you, it ought to be tolerably evident that I can't wheel my horse now." It was apparently out of the question, but Ingleby's wet face grew a trifle grim, for the assurance with which the young officer claimed precedence was exasperating, and he knew that any miner in the valley, seeing him hampered by two laden beasts, would have made way for him. One of them, it was evident, must leave the trail, but Ingleby felt that the question which that one would be was by no means decided yet. He glanced at the swirling pool below, and though he fancied there was no great depth of water, it was clear to him that even if he could lead the worn-out beast down the slippery slope of gravel, he could never drag them up again. "You should have foreseen that when I warned you to stop," he said. A little flicker of color showed in Esmond's face, but he sat easily, and as it seemed to Ingleby, insolently still in his saddle, looking at him with an excellent assumption of ironical incredulity, as though unwilling to believe that he had heard correctly. This was the more exasperating because Ingleby had his share of the sturdy English independence, and an almost unreasoning dislike of anything that savored of arrogance. It was, however, consoling to remember that in the wilderness the patrician is held of no more account than the manhood inherent in him warrants, and must either waive his claim to superiority or support it by his own resources. There was also no sign that the trooper sympathized with his officer.
"Will you be good enough to get out of my way?" asked Esmond with portentous quietness.
There was no answer, and he touched his horse with the spur. The beast floundered forward, splashing in the mire, but Ingleby stood still with a grim, wet face in the middle of the trail, and a faint trace of astonishment crept into the young officer's eyes. For, as sometimes happens in the case of men with sufficient belief in themselves, he had hitherto found the world inclined to take him at his own valuation. Now he found the position as galling as it was unexpected, for it was evident that the nerve of the wet and miry man who stood awaiting him with exasperating quietness was quite equal to his. Esmond's blood was up, and it is very probable that he would have risked the encounter had he been free from official responsibility. As it was, however, he remembered that an officer of police is not warranted in riding down an unoffending citizen, and in addition to this, the heavily laden pack horse, drawn tight across the trail, promised to prove an embarrassing obstacle, even if Ingleby had not been standing beside it with a heavy fur staff in his hand. It occurred to Esmond that there was very little to be gained except damage to his personal dignity by riding into two bags of flour, while a second pack horse, similarly encumbered, blocked the trail close behind. Thus, at the last moment, he swung himself backwards with a wrench upon the bridle, and there was a scattering of mire and gravel as his horse reeled down the slope to the river. The beast was used to the mountains, and the man had ridden from infancy, so that when they plunged into the swirling pool, he was still in the saddle. And Ingleby saw that his face was dark with a flush of anger. How he was to get out was his own business, and it was evident that he was in no danger, so Ingleby turned and gazed at the trooper, who still sat with a faint but suggestive twinkle in his eyes. "I don't want to wait here. Both the beast and I are badly played out," he said. The trooper rubbed his chin with a wet hand and glanced at his officer, who had, however, his back to him just then, as he picked his way amidst the boulders. "Well," he said, "I guess if I got down and edged out off to the off side, you might pass me. The trail is a little wider here."
"Thanks," said Ingleby, and looked at the man as he carefully led his beast by him.
The trooper also looked at him with a little comprehending grin.
"Somebody's going to make trouble if he can find a speck on anything tomorrow," he said.
He swung himself into the saddle with all the haste he could contrive, and with one eye still upon his officer. Ingleby plodded on, and as the dusk was closing in, limped into sight of a ruddy blaze among the pines. Ledger, who had heard his approach, took the pack horse's bridles, and Ingleby stood stupidly still, blinking at him.
"I've got it," he said, pointing to the flower. "Where is it to go? I'll give you a hand to heave it down."
Ledger laughed and pointed to the shanty.
"Go right in. I'll manage the bags myself," he said. "Tomlinson and the boys have been up and built us a new store shed."
Ingleby turned towards the shanty, and as he neared the doorway, a slim figure
cut against the light, and a hand was stretched out to draw him in. Then he felt a little thrill run through him as he stood in the welcome warmth with Hetty looking up at him. There was an almost maternal gentleness and compassion in her eyes, for Ingleby's face was a trifle gray, and the water ran from him. Then she turned swiftly and thrust an armful of clothing upon him. "Put them on this minute. They're warm and dry. There's a light in the new shed," she said. "Then come back here. You're not to go outside again." Ingleby was glad to obey her, and when he came back, Hetty had drawn a rude chair of deer hide towards the fire. "Sit down, and don't worry about trying to talk," she said. Ingleby sank wearily into the chair, and lay there in a state of blissful content, watching her with half-closed eyes. It was an inestimable luxury to be free from the chill of his saturated clothing and feel the warmth creep through him. But by degrees he became sensible that his contentment had more than a physical origin. The soft rustle of Hetty's dress was soothing as she laid out a simple meal. Her quick light footsteps suggested a gratifying anxiety to minister to his comfort, and he found the fashion in which she smiled at him, as she did once or twice, especially pleasant. Hetty had a spice of temper and a will of her own, but she was also endued with the kindliness which makes up for a good many deficiencies. Ingleby turned his head at last and looked at her languidly. "You make this shanty feel like home, though it is a very long while since I had one," he said. Hetty flushed ever so slightly, and Ingleby naturally did not notice it. "We've been making improvements since you left," she said. "It really doesn't need very much to make a place look comfortable." Ingleby appeared reflective. "Well," he said, "I suppose it doesn't. I don't know how you manage it, Hetty, but everything seems just as one would like it when you arrange it." "Still, that's not quite what I mean either. I'm not really sure I do know what I mean. You see, I'm sleepy." Hetty stopped close beside him and looked down with a little smile, though there was just a shade more color than usual in her face. "You are worn out and needn't worry about it until you have had supper," she said. "If I had known you would come back like this, I would never have let you go." "Still, you wanted the flower." "I didn't mean you to wear yourself out to save those lazy miners from baking their own bread." Ingleby shook his head. "I shall be all right tomorrow, and I'm going to talk," he said. "That wasn't why you sent me. One doesn't start a bakery out of philanthropy." "Well," said Hetty, "you know I wanted the money." "For Tom and me," said Ingleby reproachfully. "I felt horribly mean about it all the way to the settlement." "Is it very unpleasant, then, to let me do anything for you?" "No," said Ingleby. "That is, of course, it's generally very nice, still in this case." Hetty looked at him curiously. "Oh, I know. Still, you seem quite angry once, because I didn't care to let you lend Tom the money to bring us out." "That, of course, was very different." Hetty smiled. "Yes," she said, "when one is a girl, it usually is." Ingleby, who was very drowsy, did not seem quite sure what to make of this, and gazed meditatively at the fire. "That stone hearth wasn't there when I left," he said. "Who made it, Hetty?"
"Tomlinson.
Tom went round to tell the boys about the bakery, and Tomlinson came over to show him how to build the oven."
"And he made this chair?"
"Now I think of it, we haven't one before. And Tom certainly didn't make it. It's too comfortable."
"Yes," said Hetty.
"And he built the new shed?"
"He certainly did."
Ingleby seemed by no means pleased.
"It seems to me," he said severely, "that Tomlinson has been doing a good deal here. Now, you ought to know that when you want any improvements made, you have only to ask Tom and me."
"Could you build a chimney like that one?"
"No," said Ingleby decisively. "If I must be honest, I don't think I could. Still, there wasn't the least occasion to ask Tomlinson. He must have been here more than once."
"I believe he was here 3 or 4 times.
"Why did he come so often?"
Hetty laughed. "He said it was to see how Tom was getting on with the oven."
"Of course," said Ingleby. "Well, I suppose one excuse was as good as another. One would, however, fancy that Tomlinson had quite enough to do looking after his mine."
Hetty flashed a swift glance at him, but Ingleby was not looking at her. He was too drowsy to be quite sure of what he felt, but the fact that Tomlinson had been there on several occasions was far from pleasing him. Just then Tom Ledger came in with the kettle, which he had boiled on the fire outside, and Ingleby roused himself.
"I suppose you've struck nothing on the claim," he said.
"No," said Ledger, "only a trace of color, but I don't want to talk of that tonight. You can tell us about your journey when you have had supper."
Ingleby did so, though the narrative was distinctly tame in its unvarnished conciseness, until he came to his meeting with Esmond. He had no desire that Hetty should know what he had endured on her account. While it is, after all, difficult to make another person understand what one feels like when worn out to the verge of exhaustion, Ingleby did not attempt it, but his tone changed a trifle as he tried to picture the policeman floundering in the river. Ledger laughed softly, but the firelight showed a little flash in Hetty's eyes.
"Splendid," she said, and her voice had a little vindictive ring.
Ledger looked up with a whimsical smile.
"You appear almost as angry with the man as Walter was," he said.
"Well," replied Hetty sharply, "so I am."
It did not occur to Ingleby to wonder why the fact that the policeman had attempted to drive him off the trail should cause her so much indignation, and when Hetty abruptly asked a question, calculated to give a different trend to the subject, Ledger answered her.
"I fancy I should have endeavored to let him scrape by if I had been there," he said. "Crowding a police officer of that kind into a river may be soothing to one's ruffled temper, but I can't help concluding that it's likely to turn out expensive."
Ingleby did not answer this, and shortly afterwards retired to the tent, where he spent the next 10 hours in dreamless sleep. He rose a little later than usual next morning, but did his accustomed work at the mine. Though Ledger fancied he was a trifle preoccupied during most of the day, shortly before they left their task in the evening, they saw Tomlinson climbing the trail to their camp with a heavy burden on his shoulders. The miner had apparently got rid of it when they met him coming back, and smiled in a deprecatory fashion in answer to Ingleby's inquiring glance.
"I struck a fir that was full of resin knots when I was chopping props," he said. "It kind of struck me Miss Ledger would have some use for them at the bakery, and I just took one or two along."
Ingleby appeared rather more reflective than ever when the big miner went on, and finally laid his hand on his companion's shoulder.
"Of course, it's not exactly my business, but are you wise in encouraging that man to prowl about the shanty continually, Tom?" he said.
Ledger looked at him in astonishment.
"I'm not aware of having done it, but if it pleases him to come here, why shouldn't he?" "I suppose it doesn't occur to you that there is anything unusual in the fact that a man whose time is worth a good deal just now should spend several hours of it hacking pine knots out of trees and then scramble 2 miles with as much as a horse could carry on his back over an infamous trail?"
"You mean that he does not do it to please you or me?"
"Yes," said Ingleby, "that's it exactly. Of course, I know I'm taking an unwarranted liberty, but I had felt that Hetty could have had any liking for him. I should not have mentioned it to you. Still, don't you think it might be better if she didn't see so much of him?"
Ledger laughed.
"So far, at least, she hasn't shown the smallest sign of recognizing the merits of the fortunate Tomlinson."
Ingleby looked down across the pines.
"We are old friends, and you won't mind my saying that I'm very glad."
Well, said Ledger, who glanced at him sharply, I can't quite see why you should be. The man has an excellent character, and I like him. He has also what some folks would consider, of as much importance, a profitable mind. Still, he isn't half good enough for her, persisted Ingleby.
Ledger did not speak for a moment, and during the somewhat embarrassing silence his face grew a trifle grave. Then he said quietly, I fancy that is a point for Hetty to decide. Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaws. Thank you.